I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. You would think, with so many people forced to quarantine last year because of the pandemic, that there would have been a baby boomlet in late 2020. But it turns out that the birth rate declined last year by 4%, which, according to the CDC, was the sharpest drop in almost 50 years. It is, though, part of a several-year trend in the United States across all racial, ethnic, and economic lines. The response to this news was decidedly mixed. Some called it bad news, worrying about the economic impact, while some called it good, reflecting the choices that women and couples have about family life. Today in Radio Times, why are more women delaying parenthood, reducing the number of children that they are having, or choosing to remain childless? And we have three guests who have joined us. Joining us by Skype is Karen Benjamin Guzzo. She's a professor of sociology and a family demographer at Bowling Green State University, where she's also director of the Center for Family and Demographic Research. Joining us by Skype, Karen Benjamin Guzzo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Lauren Jade Martin. She's Associate Professor of Sociology and Women's Studies at the Berks campus of Penn State University. She researches and writes about childless women, infertility, and reproductive technologies. Lauren Jade Martin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. And rounding out our trio of guests is Gina Tomain. She's an editor and writer. Wrote a piece in Philadelphia Magazine last year titled "Why I, Like So Many of My Generation, Can't Make Up My Mind About Having Kids." She was talking about millennials. Gina Tomain, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, we want you to join our conversation, especially if it feels like we are talking about you. Here's the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Karen, let me begin with you. And I was thinking, you know, 9 months after those power outages, there always seems to be a little baby boomlet that happens 9 months later. And yet here we are talking about a pandemic which forced so many people at home, and yet we're seeing a decline in the birth rate, at least for the year 2020. What does that tell us?
Well, this decline, as you noted before, really is part of this larger decline that's been happening since the Great Recession. So for those of us who've been studying fertility rates for a while, it was not really a surprise that we saw this decline continue. And in fact, you might expect that maybe people are home all the time and, you know, they got up to a little hanky-panky while they were home. But the reality is the pandemic was sort of scary for a lot of people. This was a big altering change for people. And unlike a power outage or some other sort of short-term event, when it started to happen, people did not know what to expect. Right. It was really sort of like, oh my, so are we home now for 2 weeks, a month? When will normal will be back? But we had no idea. It wasn't exciting. It was sort of scary. Whereas, say, a power outage, or sometimes you see this for maybe a big sports event and your team wins and people are happy. This was a very different kind of event.
I hear you. You mentioned the word recession. How much of demography and even childbirth is related to economics?
A huge amount. So prior to the Great Recession, the U.S. had enjoyed relatively high fertility rates compared to our other industrialized peer countries in Europe and elsewhere. We were right above two, which is about kind of that magic number where basically everyone, a woman has two kids and she's replacing herself and her partner. So that's kind of this magic number. But after the Great Recession, we started to see that rates declined declined during the Great Recession, and they didn't really recover in part because, or at least the way that I view the literature and the research, is that we had an economic recovery that didn't really include everybody. Right. Young people really stayed behind. That's when we started to see this massive increase in student loan debt. Housing markets sort of crashed and did not rebound. And so the gig economy emerged. A lot of things happened for young people, the people who should be, you know, starting out their lives and having kids and, you know, forming families, that made them feel very uncertain about their economic futures. So I think that really depresses the decision to have children.
Well, Gina Tomain, let me get you in on the conversation. I feel like we've been talking about you kind of in front of your face here, but you are a millennial. You know, you are one of those people that graduated, if you graduated from college like 10, 12 years ago, something like that. thinking about starting a family, you know, starting some kind of a family life. How are millennials, if you can speak for your generation, how are you doing?
Sure. I mean, I don't know how much I can speak for my generation, but as far as my experience, I graduated during the recession in 2010. And I found that myself and a lot of the people I graduated with really struggled to find jobs that we felt could compensate for the massive student loan debt we'd taken on. I continued to go to grad school and had additional debt, hoping to get a better job after that. And I still, you know, have not seen my wages match with expenses in a way that would allow me to feel financial freedom. And I think that's the case across the board for many of my peers.
Well, in fact, the article that you wrote for Philadelphia Magazine almost a year and a half ago, but it was right before the pandemic, why I, like so many of my generation, can't make up my mind about having kids. Have you made up your mind?
I have not. So my husband and I continue to debate this. We have, you know, made some changes in our thinking since the pandemic, I think, because I think before the pandemic, I was very, very driven and ambitious and just really committed to my career. And now I'm kind of rethinking, where can I find more personal happiness, even if the economic systems and the social systems in the U.S. I don't think are providing adequate support. What can I do myself to change that and do the best I can to lead a happy life anyway?
I want to pick up on that, but let me get you, Lauren Jade Martin, in on our conversation. You interviewed about 70 women, and what were you looking to understand?
I was looking at women who were, there were millennials and also younger Gen Xers at the time, trying to figure out what how they would make decisions about whether or not to have children, much like Gina.
Right.
And there was a large portion, about a quarter of the women I spoke with were in that the same category as Gina, of just not knowing and not being able to figure out whether or not they wanted children, or if they did want children, whether or not they could have children. And then there were some women who did want children but were still struggling about, well, how is this ever going to happen? How will I ever have enough money? How will I be able to balance work and family? How will I find a partner to help me start raising a family?
I mean, those are a lot of really profound questions. I mean, we should say having a child is a huge responsibility. I don't want to minimize that at all. But were they wrestling with some of the same things that Gina was talking about then?
Yeah, a lot of them did not have stable jobs. They were in precarious financial situations. Many of them had a lot of student debt, just struggling about holding on to jobs. Some of them decided to work freelance jobs in order to be able to, you know, balance family life. They were thinking towards the future, thinking about, well, if I do want to have kids in the future, what can I do now to make my situation more amenable to that? And for some of them, it was finding a really stable job with benefits, while others went down a different path of thinking about, well, maybe if I went freelance, I would have more control over my time when I'm ready to have kids.
Karen, let me get you back in on the conversation. I hear some themes starting to develop here, but so much of it about just economic financial security.
Yes. And so, I mean, I want to say there's a good news in the past 10 years, which is we've seen a decline in teen births, and you've seen a decline in unintended births, where people are having births that they, you know, really didn't want to have at that moment. The flip side of this is that if we aren't having births on accident, and we're really switching to this mode where people say, when do I feel ready to have kids, because they can have access to good family planning services and whatnot, then we have to figure out what is it that people want to have, sort of what ducks do they need to have in a proverbial row before they have their kids. And so it's just what everyone else is saying. You want to feel like you're secure and you're stable. Marty, as you said, you know, having kids is a big responsibility, but it's also a huge commitment. I mean, it's 18, 20, 25 years. You know, this is not something you can take back. And so you want to say, all right, do I have a stable partnership or at least a good support network to help me out here? Do I have a good job? Can I take leave? Will I find childcare? Can I live in a safe neighborhood? And I think those things have become very, very hard for young adults to do, at the same time that we've made it really clear as a society that economic intergenerational mobility is really low. So if parents don't do everything they possibly could for their kids won't have as many opportunities in the future. So we put a lot of pressure on parents, and especially on mothers, to do all these things. At the same time, we've made it harder for people to do. And so I think that's a real concern that we need to be addressing.
In fact, Gina, you write about this in your piece in Philadelphia Magazine about your mom, but also about your grandmother, who had 10 children. You know, 8 of them survived, but nonetheless, Had no regrets, obviously, but, you know, that's a lot of kids. People are rarely having those many children these days.
Yeah, I cannot believe that my grandmother had 8 kids, and I marvel at how she did that. And, you know, she worked, and she was a nurse, and she, you know, put herself through graduate school. Her husband left her. So I think that she did a really incredible thing. And I also wonder, you know, what the landscape looked like back then, economically and socially, where her supports in her community were. I think that we're a lot more isolated now. And also, you know, I've seen that I think that things are just not not geared towards supporting women in motherhood and parental leave and all of those things that can make that possible. Yeah. Whereas she probably had a community helping her, even if it wasn't the government institutions helping her.
So she had neighbors or perhaps mm-hmm. family down the street who could help in a pinch.
Definitely.
Or even more than a pinch. Let me get you, Lauren, back in on the conversation. Is this something that the women that you talk to about are sort of where's my support system if I'm going to have a child or children?
Definitely. Many of the women I spoke with did not live they had moved away from where they grew up, so they didn't have family around. They just had maybe their partner and maybe some friends. And if they didn't have many friends who had kids, they felt totally in the wilds there about how will I have a community to help me raise this child. Right. So not having that support network or not having a partner at all also played a role in them feeling that they wouldn't be able to do this, especially if they didn't also have help from government or employers.
Do you know, and because you write about your family, did you sort of feel like, well, if my grandmother could do this, why can't I?
I did. I absolutely felt that. I think I really looked up to my grandmother in all aspects in life, and she was just a very intellectual, well-traveled woman, and I didn't know how she pulled it all off. I still don't, but so I think.
But you feel like you have to.
As something I wish that I could figure out. So I think you know, part of it is me and figuring out what I want out of life. But I do think part of it is the world that I've inherited and that I'm a part of, and I think that plays a huge role in the lack of security we can feel, you know, in this country and in our workplaces.
We're almost having a break here, but I'm thinking, you know, you were young during September 11th, for instance. We're up on the 20th anniversary of that. I'm just thinking of all these things that happen in your young life.
Sure. I think there's been constant instability. You know, talk about climate change instability. Just it hasn't been an era to grow up in where we're looking forward and saying, like, things look like they're trending positively. So I think that becomes a very difficult place to think about the future for your children when you're entire goal as a parent is to have your children have a better life than you. So if you're questioning, can I provide that? That's a big question.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. That's Gina Tomain. She's a writer and editor, has written about the fact that she, like a lot of millennials, trying to figure out when and whether to have children. Also with us, Lauren Jade Martin. She's an associate professor of sociology and women's studies at the Berks campus of Penn State University, researches about childless women. Also with us, Karen Benjamin Guzzo, professor of sociology, family demographer at Bowling Green State University, talking about the fact that we have a declining birth rate and what does it mean? Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about the fact that the U.S. birth rate declined by 4% in 2020, the sharpest drop in a number of decades. We're talking about what's behind this trend. Is it changing social attitudes about family, more choice, better contraception, the high cost of having children, the stresses of life itself? Again, we want to hear from you, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Karen, let me go back to you, and you all mentioned about family policies, whether family leave or childcare policies. How much does that affect a woman or a couple's decision to have a child?
It plays some role. what probably comes in more, to be honest, is it happens after you've already had one kid and you realize how much you, right. If you want to have another, you need more support. I think what's sort of interesting is that at those first births, you don't know what you're getting into. And I mean this in all kindness, I've had two kids. You don't know how expensive and hard it is to find childcare, or how much leave you might need after you have a baby, or how much sick time you're going to need during the course of your child's life. You don't know those things. So after you've had a kid, you're like, okay, wow, this is a lot. I'm going to need some more help here. And so there's not a ton of evidence worldwide that we could really boost fertility rates extensively or by a lot with more generous family leave policies. But there's definitely some evidence that they have a modest effect, particularly on the transition to sort of a second or third birth. But they do make people happier, to be honest. Better leave policies, more generous family policies in terms of childcare and other aspects of that. Parents in the United States are the least happy of any other country.
Really?
Because we're doing so much of it on our own, and we feel so judged by it, especially women. You're constantly judged by whether you're doing a good enough job. Are you good at work? No, because you've got kids, so no one you worry people don't take you seriously. If you are a good mother, no, because you're working too hard. So it's really hard to figure out how to win. And so we put a ton of pressure on parents. And I think policy could go a long way to sending the message that family life is important and it's valuable. And we recognize the contribution that families and parents are doing. So I would love to see more generous family policies in the United States. It certainly would alleviate a lot of pressure. And I think, again, might have some effect on whether people go on to have that second or third kid, if they're on the edge there about deciding.
Just a quick follow-up, and then I'll get our other two guests back in the conversation. When you look at countries, though, that have more generous policies, France, I think, being the most obvious example, are we seeing a decline in births in some of those countries, too?
So prior to the Great Recession, the countries that had more generous policies, with the U.S. being the one exception, did have higher fertility rates. The Great Recession sort of changed a lot. So those countries are still doing better than some of their less generous peer countries, but they've also experienced a decline in part because the Great Recession really changed how people are able to, young people are able to accumulate wealth and income and the stuff you need to feel like you're making that transition to adulthood. You know, can I actually move out of my parents' house? Can I afford to live on my own? Can I have a good job? So some of the trends we've seen in the United States, the cost of living, the gig economy, those things are pervasive. So we are seeing some of those trends throughout the world, but I think they're more exacerbated here because we have such a weak social safety net.
Interesting. Lauren, did that come up at all in the women that you interviewed?
It did, and several of the women actually spoke longingly of places like Sweden. Sweden came up all the time as sort of this ideal place in their imagination for where they would have paid time off to raise their kids and child benefits and child care and good health care. And many of them thought, were anticipating that once they did have kids, it would be really difficult for them without help from their employers or in the government.
But were they saying, I don't want to have children because we don't have the kind of policies that would help support me as a parent?
Some of them had decided not to have children at all. They didn't feel that they would have the support for that. Many of them were just putting it off until they felt, well, if I don't have things like government support or employer support, I'm going to wait until I have enough money saved up and a good support network.
Well, and Gina, you were mentioning with your grandmother and her eight children, but there was a support network. It was not government, but it was down the street.
Right. I think that she had a very close-knit neighborhood. You know, they would watch each other's kids in the neighborhood. There was family everywhere. And I think that especially with my generation, we have taken jobs in other cities. My family's back in Scranton. And I've seen some of my peers who have moved back home, whether to Scranton or to other areas, where they are lucky enough to have families that can provide support and free childcare.
Wow. Which is they did that specifically in order to be able to support themselves having kids.
Many times. Right. So I think if you want to, you know, have a child in a city where you're trying to make a career for yourself, you're going to be paying astronomical amounts for daycare. So what I've seen from friends who have had kids.
Yeah. And Karen, let me go back to you about daycare, childcare, all those.
Sure.
You know, that's a lot of money you have to pay out.
Oh, my goodness. It's so much money.
It sounds like talking like a parent yourself, right?
Yes. It's depending on where you are, if you're in a major city, you could spend $1,500, $2,000 a month on infant care. Mm-hmm. So adding another kid to that would be just sort of mind-blowing. I remember when I did this for my first child, I lived outside of Philly, and I'm thinking, oh, I was going to send my kid to the University of Pennsylvania Child Care Center, but it had a 9-month wait. And I'm like, but I've only known I'm pregnant for, 6 weeks. I'm sorry, what? And then it was, I think it was $1,400 a month. And I chose a much less expensive, but in my opinion, less preferable option because I couldn't afford something more expensive. And then I eventually moved to some place where it was much cheaper. But I mean, childcare is a huge cost. And when you're talking, this could be the amount of a mortgage payment. You can see how people are like, all right, well, then I can't afford to have a second or third child, or I have to wait. It really plays on your finances to figure out how can you literally manage all these costs. And so sometimes what you see is people deciding, well, then I'll just leave the labor force. It costs too much money. I don't make enough to offset the cost of childcare. But then you have this long-term impact of, can you get back to the labor force if you want to return when your kids are in school? What will that do to your career if that's important to you? And so families have a lot to weigh. And I say families, but it often comes down to mothers. People say, well, does your wife work, or will you work after you have kids? And no one asked dads this. And so women are saying to themselves, I want to support my family. I want to be a good mother, but I want to contribute to the household economy. I want to have my own job and career. And it's just a lot of pressure, both financially mm-hmm. and sort of emotionally.
We got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me just read a couple of comments and questions. Hannah says, I'm in my 30s and a lot of my friends are pregnant or trying to get pregnant. It seems like the rumors of a COVID baby boom may be true in my circles. Are there specific socioeconomic groups or areas of the country where the birth rate may be growing despite an overall downward trend? That's for our demographer. Karen, I'm back to you.
Sure. Yeah. So we saw that people who were least advantage, who had the most precarious jobs, were the ones who decided early on, they're like, no, I don't think I can have a kid right now. But those who had more stable jobs, who had partners in particular who had stable jobs, we are seeing that sort of married, college-educated women are thinking, this might be a good time. I might not actually have had leave otherwise if I didn't have a baby now. And so for some groups of people, they are having their kids now because they've identified that this was a good time for them. They had a little more, things were less hectic for them. And they still got paid, and their spouses still got paid. So it's really kind of this shift of who can afford now to have kids. Right. And we're seeing sort of a have and have nots for that, sort of better off, more college educated, married, stable kind of office jobs, or those people are able to have kids. And it's pretty much everybody else who is left feeling more precarious and uncertain whether they can go down that path, which is really sort of unfortunate.
Totally. And I want to pick up on that. Let me read a comment from Laura, and I'll put this to you, Lauren. Laura says, I'm in my third. I'm in my early 30s. Sorry. My biological clock drove me to madness. Now close to 50. I've been grateful every year that I do not have to worry about a child and their future, given the acceleration of climate chaos and the diminishment of democracy. I'm putting that to you, Lauren, just because I think not having children, I mean, that comes with some baggage, I think, but maybe less baggage than a generation or two ago. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, about a third of the women I spoke with, slightly more than a third, had decided that they would not have kids, and many of them identified as child-free. They use this term child-free to describe themselves. And there used to be a much more stigma towards those who decided not to have children, especially those who made that decision, not involuntarily childless. But that's reduced. People don't experience as much stigma today. It's seen more as an option that people can actually make a choice whether or not to have a child.
We were talking about just how hot it is, and she mentioned climate change. I mean, did that come up at all in the women you talked to, that they're just worried about the future?
A few women did mention the environment and climate change and just fears and war and just the state of the world as a reason to think twice about having children and bringing them into the world. But most people did not have that as their primary concern.
Jeannie, you wrote about PANKs, professional aunt, no kids, PANK. This is a thing?
Well, I think, you know, it's a term I came across. I wouldn't say that it's really caught on. You know, I think someone was trying to make it happen. Professional.
Maybe
aunt,
we
no
just
kids.
Did it on the air.
Yeah,
I don't know.
We might have just
we
made
might
it
have,
happen.
Yeah, pink.
But I have seen a lot of friends that are really thriving in an aunt role. So I have friends that are caring for a sister's child and really fulfilled by that. My sister was texting me and saying, you know, so, you know, baby fever, but in an aunt way.
Yeah,
so,
right.
I think that there is that desire from people that are very happy being child-free, but still would like to be nurturing, you know, part of the next generation. So I do see that happening.
Did you see that at all? Did that come up at all, Lauren? Which is, I don't want to be a mom, but I'd be happy to be an aunt.
Yeah, some of the child-free women didn't want to be around children, just didn't. But there are large numbers who they love kids. They really enjoy them. They just don't want to have them full-time in their house. So they enjoy that aunt role or the friend role. They would be involved in after-school programs or big brother, big sister. They enjoyed kids. They wanted to have kids in their lives. They just
not 24/7.
Not 24/7, yeah.
That's Lauren Jade Martin. She's an associate professor of sociology and women's studies at the Berks campus at Penn State University. Gina Tomain is an editor and writer here in the Philadelphia area. And Karen Benjamin Guzzo is a professor of sociology and a family demographer at Bowling Green State University. We're talking about the fact that the U.S. birth rate is declining over the last couple of years, 4% last year in 2020. We're talking about what's behind this trend and what does it say about women? What does it say about family? What does it say about our policies here in the United States? And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Karen, let me go back to you and talk about contraception and even talk about teenage births, which are also down. What is going on in this segment of the population?
Well, this is, I think, part of the really good news we can take away from the declining birth rates, which is, you know, we had this high teen birth rate in the early 90s, and we really put a focused effort on giving comprehensive sex ed, rather, in schools, and making sure teens have the ability to understand what they need to do to avoid getting pregnant. But it's also about making sure we have access. So since the Affordable Care Act was implemented, and there's obviously been lots of challenges to that, but one of the main parts has been increasing contraceptive access and making contraception available at no cost. So this means assuming teens can access it, which is again still somewhat of an issue, that you can get the pill, you can get an IUD, you can get something effective that can really help you avoid getting pregnant. And so if we can give teens the knowledge they need to know, the knowledge they need to have to avoid getting pregnant, and the access to the methods that actually do it, this is great. And so we're seeing this decline in birth rates. We're also actually seeing a decline, though, in teen sex. So that's part of it. As we tell kids, they're young people. Mm-hmm. As we tell them, you know, here's what you can do for your future. You need to plan your life. You need to figure out what you want to do for a career and what, you know, do you want to go to college? What kind of life do you want to have? And to give them sort of some actual forward orientation, something to think about in the future, it helps them have goals that say, well, if I were to have sex now, or if I were to have a baby right now, that would really interfere with the things I want to achieve in my life. So I think this is all good news. The flip side of it is just making sure that if what we've said to them is, well, when you go to college, you'll get a good job, and then you'll be able to afford a good life, we need to make sure we follow through with that as a society. So we need to not burden them with all these student loan debts, and we need to make sure that there are good jobs out there. But I mean, this is, I think, a really good thing, though.
Absolutely.
In terms of the declining birth rates for teens.
Underscore, absolutely. Here's an email from Victoria. So far, this conversation seems to have started with the idea that there has to be a reason not to have children. Perhaps we should not make having children the default position. Maybe the question should be more like, of all the ways a given woman can contribute to the world, is that the best way? Maybe that is the question women are asking. Can I toss that over to you, Lauren?
Sure. No, I love that that framing. And I love the idea of not thinking about motherhood as inevitable for all women, just thinking, what do you want in your life? Maybe children is a part of that. Maybe not. Maybe having your own children is a part of it. Maybe being a great aunt is another way to do that.
Yeah, do you want to add to that?
I completely agree. I think that it certainly does not have to be the default and should not be the default. I think my approach was coming at it from someone debating that for myself. But I think many women that I found are very satisfied with pursuing other passions and contributing to society and doing a lot of other things that give their life meaning. And I think that's absolutely true.
Here's a comment from Barbara, who's a retired pediatrician. I can't believe no one is talking about men in this conversation. I thought about that, Karen. Actually, can you weigh in on this? Because largely it takes two to make a baby. But yeah, go ahead.
Yes, it does. And I don't disagree with that. That is a long-term problem we've actually had for those of us who study childbearing is, you know, where are the men? This is only half the solution or half the problem here. And so men, part of it's actually, though, that when we think about parenthood, we socialize kids and really girls to think about what do you want to be a mommy? Do you want to play with toys and babysit, that kind of stuff? And so men think of having kids, but they think of it, I think, in this more sort of vague, well, of course they'll have kids someday when I get married, because it's a package deal to them. They can't really envision having kids on their own. They're not socialized to think about, you know, what are you going to name your kids when you grow up? And so men are part of this story, and increasingly we need to pay attention to them, because in particular, if men want kids, they need to find a partner. But also, if women want to have kids, they should find a partner who's going to contribute to being a good parent. They need a really good co-parent. And so we know that when women have partners who are more involved in parenting, that makes the parenting experience much easier. Men enjoy it less. Men enjoy parenting less when they take on more parenting responsibilities, because parenting is hard. but it also is much better for children's well-being. And in the long term, men are more involved and have better relationships with their kids and with their spouses when they're more involved parents. But we have not studied men enough. I think that's a sort of a big glaring gap that we have in the field.
Sure, fair enough. And here we are, four women talking about it together.
Yes.
Absolutely. Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That was Karen Benjamin Guzzo, again, professor of sociology, a family demographer at Bowling Green State University, where she's the director of the Center for Family and Demographic Research. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio, Lauren Jade Martin, associate professor of sociology and women's studies at the Berks campus of Penn State University. And she researches and writes about childless women, infertility, and reproductive technologies. And rounding out our trio of guests is editor and writer Gina Tomain. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about babies and birth rates with our guests, Karen Benjamin Guzzo, Lauren Jade Martin, and Gina Tomain. Gina, we were talking during the break about what often happens is if a couple has a baby, there's kind of a deficit for the woman and a benefit for the men. Can you speak to that?
Yes, when I was researching for my story that I reported on, I came across a study that had found a motherhood wage penalty and a fatherhood bonus, whereas men made more money after having children, but women actually made less. And I think that makes sense given the fact that many women would be potentially taking on less of a role at work or dropping out of the workforce in order to provide that childcare. And even today, when we do see more men participating in childcare and being more aware of these things, it's typically women that are taking on most of the work, I would say, and it's difficult to make that shift.
Let me toss something to you, Karen, and then I want to toss something to you, Lauren. What about family leave policies, Karen? And you know, sometimes these policies are a couple weeks, maybe a couple months if you're lucky. How does that factor in?
Yeah, so I just want to quick go back. So the motherhood wage penalty, what's interesting is that it's not always because women have chosen to leave. It's because their employers sometimes say, well, you're a mom now, so I don't want to give you this big, long task. You're going to have to stay late. So it's this idea that women don't want to be committed to their jobs, even when they could be. And I think that's a problem, too. And then with leave, there is this expectation that, when you come back, you won't be back full strength, so to speak. It's very uneven whether you can take leave. So the American policy as it is now nationwide is that you can get up to 3 months leave unpaid, which means who can take, 3 months unpaid unless you're maybe partnered. But it also means men almost never take this leave. So if who's going to take it, it's going to be women. Women will stay home and then they come back and it's looked like they get on this sort of mommy track. Some countries have policies for men where they have to take leave at least 2 weeks, and it's a use it or lose it, so you can't just let the mom take it. The men have to stay home, and it's a signal to say, you know what, you also had a baby too, fathers. you need to be involved. Your life should change. And so it is hard, unless we have sort of these big structural shifts, to allow people to have the kind of leave they need to have to stay home and bond with their kids, but also so that we don't set up a system where if only one person takes leave and it tends to be mom, then moms become the more competent parent. They become the default parent. They become the one who knows how to do things more because dads just had less practice. And then on the flip side, my husband used to give these talks at work, and he would show pictures of our daughters at the end of his slide. People would ooh and on, think he's a great dad. And I'm thinking, oh my God, as a professional woman, I would never show pictures of my kids because I was told when I went on the job market a long time ago, not to mention that I was married and had a kid.
Really?
And I'm thinking, wow, there's, things are so different that men get this like, oh, you're a great dad when your kids are wearing mismatched clothing and they're, you're trying your hardest. And, mothers are just not getting that same sort of boost. We judge mothers and fathers very differently, which in every aspect, but in the labor force, it carries a lot of long-term implications.
Lauren, let me ask you just a couple of personal questions, because my understanding is that you have decided not to have children. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but...
Yeah, I made that decision long ago. I remember as a teenager riding the subway with my mother and telling her, just so you know, I'm never going to have kids.
So and you were young.
Yeah, I knew that from a very young age. And so some of the women in my study really identify as... like I said, as child-free, they see this as a core part of their identity, whereas other people, it's just sort of something they fall into. They just wind up being childless. And yeah, for me personally, I don't necessarily identify as child-free. It's definitely a decision I came to at quite a young age.
And just said, it's just not going to fit into who I am or how I want to live my life.
Yeah, just motherhood itself just has not appealed to me. I like being the professional aunt with no kids. That role suits me quite well, and I love children, but I don't have the orientation towards being a mom.
But what's so interesting? There's so many different ways to be a family these days. I mean, I think that's one of the good things. We've got we've got gay families, and we've got partner families and extended families. And I mean, I think the heterosexual nuclear family probably is a dying breed. But I'm back to you, Lauren. There's just what's so interesting on the other flip side is just how many different ways we can be families.
There's so many ways to be families. I've talked to people who are there in three-person relationships or cross-country relationships. They were many of the women in my study were in same-sex partnerships. Some of them, they had foster children. They took in their sister's kids. They were just multiple ways of being a family, and that's just something that when we think about what family looks like today, that nuclear two-parent household heterosexual married family is just a sliver of what we see today.
Yeah. Have you thought about that, Gina, too? I mean, just the multiple ways of being a family.
Yeah, I think that is such a good point and so important to this conversation. I am talking about my relationship being cis-hetero and, couples in that way. But I think that is a small sliver of what we see today. I think there are, friendships that are these incredible relationships and family and so many different types of relationships these days. So I do not think this conversation should be limited to just that binary at all.
No. Yeah. Karen, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, so what I think is interesting is some of the concern we hear over declining birth rates is also, or at least has a subtext of a declining certain type of family, that there is one main type of family we're all supposed to have. It's the married, you know, cis hetero family. And the reality is there are lots of ways to be families. And that's exactly your point. But when people say we need to increase birth rates, they're very specific that they want to increase certain types of births to certain types of people. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, a real problem when we have this conversation without thinking of what kind of families we privilege in the United States. So if you are together with your partner, but you're not married, you're not eligible for all sorts of partnership things that we give to married people. And so there's a lot of conversation to be had. I mean, we have people who want to be parents who are single and are willing to adopt. But if they are gay, for instance, in some states, you're still not really allowed to. And so there's a lot of ways that we could be families, and we need to make sure that if we want to encourage families, we need to do it broadly, I think.
There was a note up here about climate change, and I'm back to you, Gina. I mean, did that some people saying, look, it's we were talking about how hot the weather is, but sort of worry about rising seas and how can I bring my child into a world that you know, may not exist in 50 years? I'm overstating the problem, of course, but
I think that that plays into the overall outlook on, you know, where society is and where it's headed. And it certainly plays a role in looking at, you know, everything in a wide perspective. It wouldn't be in what I've come across people's primary reason. I also think that, you know, we want to be pushing against a society, corporations and government that aren't prioritizing fixing these issues for future generations. And that does play into a role about whether you want to have kids, because mm-hmm. if you see these problems continually exacerbated, I think that's the difficulty there. But I don't think it would never be a personal decision for me not to have a child due to climate change. I think it's more of a corporate responsibility that's not being met.
Here's an email from William. Any problems caused by a shrinking population would be dwarfed by problems brought by a growing one. We adopted our daughter, and I love, 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 love raising her. A comment from a listener. I had a baby this year, and it was lovely to spend time at home with my new son, but also extremely difficult. Can you discuss the emotional stresses of the past year as a factor? The pandemic was stressful for each individual in a different way. And Karen, you mentioned that, you know, that a power outage is not the same as being stuck home for 9 or 10 or 12 months with a family or someone else. Can you speak to that?
Sure. So I think, you know, early on in the pandemic, we heard stories of people having to give birth all by themselves in hospitals, which I think is just that's absolutely terrifying. And then, you know, people are having babies, and that's great, but then they can't see their relatives. Their own parents can't come over. You can't go to mommy and me play dates. You can't take your baby on walks to the park because you're too worried. I have a 6-month-old nephew that I've not met yet. You know, and so it's very isolating for people to have babies right now and to be all alone. I think things are opening up, which is great, but this was a really tough year. So if you add on top of that, you know, the stress of new parenthood, which is just difficult in itself, and then you might have job insecurities, and we're all massively isolated. And, you know, Zoom and all these things are great, but they don't connect you in the same way as being in the same room with, you know, the people who you care about. And so for new parents this year, it might have been nice to have longer leave and spend more time with their kids than they might have had they been working, because we have such a bad family leave policy country, but it's very isolating.
Yeah.
It is really isolating to, even in normal circumstances, to have a baby. Babies require so much work, but they don't talk back much. and they're not good companions sometimes.
Not until they get older. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then my kids are teens, and I wish they talked a little less sometimes. but, you know, it's really difficult to be a new parent on your own. And I think Gina was mentioning sort of this idea, like having a village and having people to, you know, be with and share the parenting load with. And it's something you definitely didn't have during the pandemic.
Well, Gina, have we scared you into or out of having a baby now that, you know, we're almost through our conversation here? I mean, I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about this, so I'm not making light of that.
No, I appreciate that. No, I think it's really always fascinating to talk about, and I think there's always kind of new facets I uncover when I'm talking with other people. So it's something I'm going to continue to wrestle with. I think there's just so many complex issues, you know, in play here.
Sure. And Lauren, will you continue to sort of explore some of this? And we should add that there are reproductive technologies that allow older people, women, men and women, to have children. So it's an interesting, as we look at the birth rate, it could be the people just delaying it, putting it off until they're frankly older.
Well, that's how I got into studying this topic. So I was studying egg freezing about 10 years ago. And the thought there, from at least from the fertility industry, was that, oh, this is a new way to deal with the problem of women delaying pregnancy and then not being able to have children without medical intervention. So then I had the question about, is technology actually pushing women to delay? And most of the women I talked to did not see that as – they knew it was there, but they weren't counting on it. They knew it was very, very expensive if they did decide to go down that road of egg freezing or in vitro fertilization.
And I don't even know if that's covered by insurance or not.
In most places it is not, unless their employer – some places have employer benefits.
Karen, let me go back to you. We're talking about the decline in the birth rate. Is there a magic number about, you know, replacement birth? What do we have a goal that we shouldn't be looking for, at least demographically speaking?
Sure. So there's a lot of talk about what's called the replacement rate, which is having, on average, 2.1 kids. I mean, obviously no one has 0.1, but 2.1 across the country on average. We don't need to be right there necessarily to make sure we have a steady, stable population, because we have such high rates of immigration in the United States relative to other countries. So our country can continue to grow even if we don't have women having on average about 2 kids. The question is how much of the decline in births right now is really a delay. So what you were just saying, which is people who would have been having their kids maybe in their late 20s and early 30s are now going to have them in their late 30s. So some people who aren't having births now, are they going to kind of make up for that lost time in their late 30s? And there's a good chance they'll make up some of it. Some people will probably end up having fewer births than they wanted. So my concern is less about what at the population level, at the national level, do we need to have? Do we need to have an average of 2 or 2.3 or 1.8? My concern more is if people are saying they want to have, you know, 2 kids on average, and are they able to? And right now we know they're not able to have the kids that they want to have, which is, I think, sort of an indictment of how hard it is to kind of successfully launch yourself into adulthood and to form a family in the United States.
Do we need more immigration or more immigrants to sort of balance out some of these populations?
It would not be a bad idea. Immigrants add a lot to our country, and not just in terms of bodies. You know, we know when immigrants come, they tend to be younger, so they work at higher labor market rates than other people, other groups, demographic groups. They often are the age where they would have kids anyway, so they add both directly to themselves, and then they have kids of their own in the United States. But they also, I think, do a great job of making our country more interesting and more vibrant. Unfortunately, over the past few years, but first in the Great Recession, we had sort of an economic-induced decline in migration. And then in recent years, it's been because we've just had a very strongly anti-immigrant sentiment in the United States, and particularly in some of our governmental offices. So if we could keep immigration going and sort of return, we would not have as much of this concern about population size and population growth or even some of these economic concerns.
Let me squeeze one more comment in from Mary. How much of an issue is the older generation's inability or refusal to help with childcare? I live close to both grandparents and their help is not consistent enough for me to hold a full-time job. Friends of mine have parents still working full-time, so they cannot or will not help. Gina, that's something that you raised. It was more sort of personal about your grandmother, but you know, people are busy.
Yeah, I think we are seeing a lot of people working, you know, very late into life. And also, it's an incredibly privileged thing to be able to have parents that can help you with your children. And that is something that is not by any means available to everyone. So I think that is something that can be helpful to a privileged few, but that is only a few. I think maybe there's other community organizations that can come together, neighborhoods, and people can try to help each other more, but it's not the way our society is set up right now, from what I've seen. So I think there needs to be, you know, kind of big shifts towards that if we want to be finding our own solutions.
We have to end there, but one more comment, one from Bill. He says, I love the daughter my wife and I adopted. A lot of men choose fatherhood with open eyes. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Karen Benjamin-Guzzo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. This was great.
It was great for us as well. And she's a professor of sociology and family demographer at Bowling Green State University, where she's the director of the Center for Family and Demographic Research. Lauren Jade Martin, thanks for coming in. Thanks for joining us as well.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Associate professor of sociology and women's studies at the Berks campus of Penn State University. And Gina Tomain, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Again, she's an editor and a writer here in the Philadelphia area. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for all those comments.